A number of who have risked death by drowning to get here. I must confess, I thought seriously of calling in dreadfully sick myself, but I finally decided I would come because today we will deal with the rise and fall of empire after empire after empire after empire. One of the things which is a fairly consistent feature in history from this time on for all the rest of the quarter is the appearance of vast movements of people, most of which start up in those steppes of Central Asia. It is an area which, if it has a whole series of, you'll pardon the expression, rainy years, there is enough forage to support a large population. Then when a series of dry years would come along, eventually this overpopulation would be forced to move, usually to the south, looking for richer and more fertile land. And it is this which gives rise to this series of migrations of peoples out of the north. Now, there are a number of these, and they don't come all that frequently, but they do come periodically. We've seen that you had Egypt rise as a major state and grow into an empire, and by the 18th century BC, Egypt possessed a very large empire that extended up into Syria. At the same time, the city-states of Sumer and Akkad grew, and occasionally one of these conquered a number of other city-states and created what is sometimes called a small empire headed by or sometimes by Lagash, other city-states. And this was succeeded in time by the rise of the first great state of Babylon. Now, Babylon is located at the spot where the two rivers, Tigris and Euphrates, come closest together. And from the founding of Babylon on, we're going to find a whole long series of capital cities that are built in roughly this same location. Within 2 hours out of Baghdad today, you can find half a dozen sites that were once great capital cities, now lying, of course, in ruins. And I must say the ruins are not madly exciting. Mud brick does tend to decay terribly. What you have left are mainly either shapeless mounds or shapeless pits. And while I have been to look at them, I am not very good at deciphering either shapeless mounds or shapeless pits. But that's what much of it looks like today. Nonetheless, that first Babylonian empire, which had Hammurabi and the Great Law Code, finally gave way to a smaller group of Kassites, who had a much weaker empire. And somewhere around the period between 2000 and 1800, there came a major wave of peoples coming down out of the north, somewhere. These people came down into Asia Minor, and another group, in fact, go down into the Greek Peninsula, and we'll run into those later. The group that go down into Asia Minor are the peoples known as the Hittites. And we have remnants of their cities, and we know that the Hittites, starting around 1800, slowly created a very large and powerful empire, which eventually controlled what we would call Syria today, and extending down with basic hegemony over the rivers as far as Babylon. Now, the Hittites brought their own religion, but this, too, took on Sumerian overtones eventually. And the one thing that we are apt to remember the Hittites for, more than anything else, is that these are the first persons to use iron weapons. Now, they did not discover the technique of forging iron. That seems to have been discovered up in the mountainous area of Armenia, actually, which was just on the borders of the Hittite Empire. But certainly the information spread down to the Hittites and Hittites are the first ones to make major use of iron for weapons. From there, you can literally follow the spread of iron as tools up into Europe and down into Egypt. The Egyptians, as a matter of fact, resisted the use of iron. They considered this an ignoble metal as opposed to bronze, which they thought was a noble metal. The trouble was, of course, that iron kept smashing their bronze up into small bits, and eventually they decided that ignobility was better than total defeat. So they took up iron also. But Hittites were notorious for this, and they seem to have had a quite well-run empire, centered there in Asia Minor, in Hylas. However, around the period of roughly 1200 to 1100, there came another great wave of peoples from the north streaming down in. Again, they head straight into Asia Minor for those rich, fertile lands of the Fertile Crescent. And they also head into the Greek Peninsula, this time to be known as the Dorian Invasion. This is that same group of persons who reached all the way down the coasts of the Mediterranean to Egypt and were there stopped by Ramses IX. They were known as the Sea Peoples to the Egyptians, and certainly some of them perhaps were involved in waves of sea migration. But what was accomplished specifically was the destruction of the Hittite Empire. And the result of this left for a time being one of those things that is called a power vacuum in the Middle East. In other words, a period in which there is no single great empire that is dominant, but instead you had a period of the rise of a series of small states. Now, there are a whole group of these. It's about this time, and a little before, in fact, that the Phoenicians begin their rise to fame and power. Now, the Phoenicians inhabited some coastal cities along the coast of Syria. Particularly Tyre and Sidon are the most famous of them, but there are half a dozen others. And they are specifically a merchant peoples and a seagoing peoples. They did not develop any very strong cultures of their own. Like most of these Middle Eastern groups, they tended to worship a series of gods, Baals, with temples and so on. But they are most famous, of course, for taking over the carrying trade in the Mediterranean. Now, the original carrying trade had been handled by the Cretans. And as the Cretan power fell, and again we'll come back to that next week, the Phoenicians inherited this. And the Phoenician merchant marine, which is what it was, became the factor that carried goods from the Middle East down to Egypt, all through the eastern Mediterranean, and they then began to penetrate into the western Mediterranean. Notably, they began to found colonies in North Africa. And eventually, by the 8th century, they had founded the great colony of Carthage. Now, Carthage was to be an independent city that would eventually found its own empire in the western Mediterranean and would, in its own turn, have a series of colonies. The Phoenicians penetrated into the Black Sea. They penetrated throughout the Mediterranean and out into the Atlantic. We know that the Phoenicians got up as far north as Britain, where they regularly went on voyages for tin, and we know that they also got down at least partway around the African coast. Now, there are early stories which suggest, indeed, that the Phoenicians may have gotten very far down the African coast, but there is no proof of this of any kind. And there are, of course, those endless, marvelous myths about Phoenicians making it to the New World by chance or so on. There is, again, no active proof of this so far. Nonetheless, the Phoenicians are major shipping and mercantilist people. They borrowed culturally from every group they came in contact with. And one of their major borrowings, which they spread, was that famous thing called the Phoenician alphabet. Now, the Phoenician alphabet was almost certainly not invented by the Phoenicians either. It seems, in fact, to have been invented by the Aramaeans around Damascus. The Aramaeans and Damascus was a great desert trading center. All kinds of trade routes came into it, and they seem to have experimented with some kind of alphabet which would combine elements from Egypt and from the cuneiform of Sumer and Babylon. And out of this, they worked up a genuine alphabet of 22 letters. Now, all of those letters represented consonants. Again, there are no vowels represented by letters. And that was taken over by the Phoenicians. Now, that is the foundation, in fact, of all the alphabets today. So that we do inherit from Damascus to the Phoenicians spreading it to the Greeks, and on from the Greeks to the Romans and down to us. So this is one thing we get from the Phoenicians. Now, the Phoenicians were rich and powerful states, or city-states, in fact, in coalition. Down south of them, along the southern seacoast, you had a group of cities like Ascalon and Gaza, which had been taken over by the Philistines. Now, the Philistines were a part of these peoples from the north, the people who had invaded and been stopped by Ramses IX, then settled along that seacoast. They were probably very, very distant kissing cousins of the historical Greeks. And we do know, of course, from the biblical stories that the Canaanites and the Hebrews found them enormous in size, wearing all kinds of heavy armor, giants, Goliath is a Philistine, and you should think of Goliath as perhaps reaching that stately height of perhaps 6'2". But since the normal Semites tended to be perhaps 4'10", that's pretty giant size. And the result is that they go down through this. Now, they established, again, very strong cities along that seacoast. Inland from them were established the Canaanites around Jericho, Jerusalem, all of these little centers. And it is, of course, into this area that the Hebrews penetrated. Again, in this same period of the power vacuum. Semitic tribes coming in from the Sinai and battling the Canaanites to take over. The conquest of Jericho is famous for all of you and needn't be gone into. The Hebrews, as they came in, tended to establish two separate groups of tribes. One to the north, which eventually was to coalesce into the state of Israel, and another group to the south, which coalesced into the state of Judah. And as they first took over, these become two separate territories in the so-called period of the Judges. Now, it isn't until you come to the period of the kings, and more particularly of David, that you get the conquest of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem established as the new capital of a united state. Now, this united state begins that rather small golden age of the Hebrews. It's the period when their power, particularly under David and Solomon, reached its greatest extent, all the way up to Damascus, in fact, and in which they made alliances with the Philistines, constantly battled the Philistines, and established themselves as the major power in the southern part of the Fertile Crescent. Now, the Jews, of course, were to be and have remained a very special people in history, not so much because of their political position, but very specifically through their religion. They had, indeed, a religion which was intrinsically different from that of the surrounding Arabs. There are arguments about how early it becomes a true monotheism, and I don't want to get into those discussions. There's a great deal written on it, and varying views. What does matter is that from the very earliest time, they are the chosen people of their God, and what's more, unlike the other Semitic groups or the Sumerians, they have contact with their God. Now remember that the Sumerians never knew what it was that their God wanted them to do. How could they be appeased? So they're always nervous about this. The Jews knew what their God wanted. He told them. He sent them down a set of laws. And if you follow this set of laws, then your tribes will increase and you will take over. This is the promise of God to them. So that quite genuinely, they uniquely have this kind of security. What's more, of course, there was a continuing source of revelation for the Jews through the prophets. A series of prophets who tended to appear and to speak the will of God to those peoples to try to keep them following the laws and from falling away into the heresies of Baal worship, maintaining the purity of the people. All of these aspects are kept alive through the prophets. Now, all of this tended to flourish and to create a kind of religiously stable and continuing state. It was, of course, to fall on bad times once you had the power vacuum ending and a new great empire forming in that era. Even before that new empire is very far off the ground, you had had a split between the northern and southern states, which had divided again into separate parts, the richer kingdom of Israel to the north and the poorer kingdom of Judah down to the south here. This weakened the state, and indeed the golden days were over with the death of Solomon and the division of the kingdom into two parts. The empire that was rising at this time was the empire of the Assyrians. Now, the Assyrians lived up on very stony plateaus near the headwaters of the Tigris River. It was lousy land, and in fact, it still is lousy land. Though they discovered oil under it, which would help around Mosul. Nonetheless, it meant that it was a small population and a sturdy population. They depended on horse raising and on horses for part of their wealth. And for a period of several centuries after the fall of the Hittite Empire, they managed to maintain their independence, largely because they were too sure for anyone to want to take them over. And they were also warlike and repelled invasions with a good deal of success. Eventually, as this period went into the power vacuum, they were able to increase their wealth, and they began slowly to become more powerful. Now, their great days do not really come until the 9th century and particularly the 8th century BC. This is the golden age of the Assyrian power. And the Assyrians are, I suppose, the least liked and the most hated peoples of antiquity. The Assyrians are the first that I know of in history to follow terrorism as an active political weapon. The Assyrians, very early on, formed a practice of raiding out from their rocky plateaus down to the richer neighboring areas and simply raiding cities and taking tribute, food, gold, anything they could find there, and carrying it back to Assyria. Now, they developed a terrorist policy in part so that next year when they went raiding again, there would be less opposition and people would just, you know, give them what they wanted, just take it and go away. So they followed the practice of when they captured a city, of simply demolishing part of the city and much of the population. They slaughtered off the population and they leave vast inscriptions in which they boast, for instance, of building towers outside the city gates, of hands from the men, of noses, of the heads of the young men of the city, They boast, for instance, of having impaled the rulers of a city. If you don't know what it is, impaling is a system whereby you sharpen a stake with the sharpened end standing up out of the ground, and then you simply plant a person on this, and his own weight will slowly carry him down. It takes up to 48 hours to die that way, unless you kick very effectively and end it sooner. It is grinning. Now, there's a lot of boasting of this kind of thing, and as you can see, it is not guaranteed to make you endearing to the person that you're dealing with. So the Assyrians have a horrid name in history. Their great period comes when they reach the point where they stop this yearly raiding and decide that in the long run it will be more effective if they simply put their own governors in the conquered cities and take over the control of them and have a regular yearly tribute. Now, once this is decided on as policy, the golden age of Assyria takes over, because now they mushroom out. And the Assyrians, in fact, conquer Babylon. They conquer down all through Syria. They conquer the state of Israel. The state of Judah is left independent but must pay tribute. And they also conquer the decaying state of Egypt. So this is a vast and enormous empire, and it furnishes them with yearly tribute. They establish their own governors, and they also establish the practice of moving conquered peoples, so that you have them, once they conquer the state of Israel, for instance, they simply kill off the leaders of the state of Israel and move the peoples around within the empire. And it is from this that you have the lost 10 tribes of Israel. It's from the Assyrian conquest here. So the feeling being, of course, that if they split tribal units up, they are unable to coalesce again into strong enemies. And this way you diminish all kinds of opposition. The Assyrians built a series of capitals. Indeed, by the 8th century, almost each new king has a tendency to build himself a new state capital and move people to it. Nineveh is, of course, the most famous of these Assyrian cities. But as the Assyrians took this over, they constantly created this enormous enmity. There were rebellions against Assyria periodically, usually put down with enormous ferocity. But they continued. And finally, in the year 612 BC, there is a final rebellion. Now, it's a rebellion that is spearheaded by three groups in particular. One of these is the Babylonians. Another one is the state of the Medes. Now, the Medes are in what we would today call northwestern Iraq, from that particular area. And the third group were the Lydians, and these were from Asia Minor. Again, a wealthy group. Now, these three groups formed a conspiracy against the Assyrians, and the Egyptians were also asked to join in this conspiracy. The Egyptians did join, but they were so slow in getting there that Nineveh had fallen in 612 before the Egyptians made it up there. And I must say, when Nineveh fell, it fell with a thundering crash. Its destruction had, of course, already been prophesied by the prophet Jeremiah, who said that when this wicked city fell, that it would never again be built on, that it would be the haunt of the wolf and the jackal and the owl. And that was to come very precisely true, which I must say did give Jeremiah a lot of clout among the Jews. Because the destruction of Nineveh was extraordinarily complete, and in fact, no new city was ever to be raised on the site of Nineveh. Very close today to the city of Mosul, but it's notable that when Alexander the Great marched his armies past it, that no one indeed knew that they were passing the site of ancient Nineveh. It was just a series of shapeless mounds
rising slightly above the soil of the plains. So the Assyrians fell and were banished from history. And in their place, the new states rose. Now, out of those new states, Egypt was not to be of great importance. It has small periods of independence, but a constant series of conquests, as I had told you before. The same states that rose were Lydia in Asia Minor. Now, Lydia was a kingdom of the interior, and it was very rich because, indeed, there are gold-bearing rivers that flow through this area, and Lydia was, indeed, the first place to start minting gold coins. It also was eventually to capture the Greek cities of the Aegean coast and to establish itself as a major power in the Mediterranean era. Yes? L-I-L-Y-D. Lydia. Libya is down in North Africa. Yes. Okay. Sorry about that. And the other power, of course, that rose was Babylon. This is the great second empire of Babylon, and Babylon now became a new major power with an enormous new city. It's the remains of that city that exists today. This is the famous Babylon, said to have had a circuit of walls 56 miles around. Those are the very outer walls, not the inner walls. Inner walls that were so broad that two chariots could pass each other on the top of those walls. This is the city of Nebuchadnezzar. This is the city of the famed Hanging Gardens. All of these factors. So it was an enormously rich and splendid city that rose here. And Babylon, of course, went off on its own series of conquests up into the area of Syria and of Palestine. And here, indeed, it did at long last take over Judah as well. This is the period of the Babylonian captivity, when the Jews are removed from Judah and are taken down to Babylon in captivity there. There are those whole series of songs by the sweet waters of the Euphrates and so on, and a whole series of famed happenings, of course, in the Bible. From that Babylonian captivity, the young men in the furnace, Nebuchadnezzar going wild and eating grass, all of them. Actually, there seems no historical reference to his going mad at all, but that's beside the point, perhaps. So that Babylon grew great, and the other area that grew great, of course, was the kingdom of the Medes. M-E-D-E-S. Now, the Medes had not appeared strongly in history before, but they managed to control approximately the area of most of what is Iran today. And this was to be the new great center, because the Median Empire had not gone very long, only down into the middle of the 6th century, before there was a revolution there, and a Persian house took over and became the rulers of this territory, and it turns now into the Persian Empire. It is not so much a matter of conquest. It is essentially simply a change of dynasty that goes on here. This is under the great king Cyrus. Now, Cyrus and the Persians came from roughly southern Persia, from a rather poor and stony part of the country, but Cyrus was to be one of the great kings of history. Cyrus is one of the great and conquering kings. What he managed to do was to take over the empire and to get the Medes and the Persians to operate together. There is no question of one dominating the other. The imperial guard is always made up of half Persians and half Medes. So this is an easy takeover by the Persians. However, Cyrus then goes out on a period of conquest. The next area, place to fall, is the Empire of Babylon. Babylon itself is taken and falls to Cyrus. and the whole empire falls with it, of course. It's notable that it is Cyrus and the Persians who decide to return the Jews back to their holy land, and this is when that Babylonian exile of the Jews comes to an end. The Jews are allowed to return, and there they reestablish themselves in their old centers, more particularly, of course, in the southern states around Jerusalem itself. So that this marks the return of the Jews. Now, the general history of the Persian Empire is this. You have for some time a series of strong rulers, Cyrus, Darius, a series of others, combined armies out on a new war of conquest. So you get an ever widening and increasing size to this great Persian Empire. It becomes indeed the greatest of all of the ancient empires in extent. In extent, it will eventually go all the way from the Indus River in India, right straight across the part of the southern part of the steppes, all of what is today Iran, all of the Fertile Crescent, all of Egypt, all of Asia Minor, and there will be fascinating campaigns up into the southern steppes of Russia, and of course, very famous ones we'll study later against the Greeks. So this is a huge empire. It's an empire which tends to add on generation after generation. It is true that there are these periodic outbreaks and there are problems. For one thing, you have one thing that tends to devil these Mideastern kingdoms and empires, and this is the harem system. Now, harem systems may or may not be fun for the man, but they are politically deadly. And they're always deadly politically. Because what you usually have is a series of wives and a series of concubines, and if the king is active enough, a whole swatch of kids by various ones. Now, this is what sets up the trouble. There are favorite wives who are replaced, and all of the wives want their sons to be the next ruler. It does tend to make for a certain amount of real wickedness in the harem. scandal, murder, assassination, plots, counterplots. It's just not worth it, I would say, offhand. And it is this that gives rise to these constant troubles when the king dies. Then there are apt to be several persons claiming the succession, small civil war before these things are decided. It tends to be one of the major weakening forces. You have only to think of King Solomon, for instance, to realize that he gets into this with, I don't mean Solomon, I mean David, with those two older boys who rebel against him, and eventually it's Solomon, who is Bathsheba's son, a very late-coming wife indeed, who manages to inherit. It's the same harem problem, and this simply is a constant factor all through this. Just remember that lots of these wives are political marriages as well, that you marry into families whose support you want, or into heads of conquered areas to add support. All of this simply makes the internecine family quarreling all the worse. Boy, you talk about sibling rivalry, this is where you get it. This is a weakening factor, and it shows up extremely early in the Persian Empire. Nonetheless, the Persian Empire is far and away the best governed empire that we know of in ancient times up to this time. It seems to have made a real specialty of trying to play fair with the conquered peoples. Typical is this business of sending the Jews back to their homeland. Persia is divided up into 40 satrapies, or large provinces. These are ruled by governors who are sent out by the king, who will maintain order and the king's law in the various provinces. But notably, the king does not of necessity trust them. He also has officials called the king's eye. And these are officials that are appointed by the king who report back to him personally. And they are sent out to the various provinces to make sure that no rebellion is being fomented, that the taxes are getting back to the king, that the taxes and laws are being followed justly and fairly, so that the kings have a constant check to make sure the governors rule wisely and well. Beyond this, the Persians really established a magnificent set of early roads. They established roads and post houses where fresh horses were kept so that king's couriers could move with enormous speed across this far-flung empire, bringing news to the capital and to the king. There were four capitals to the Persian Empire. The winter capital was Babylon. The winter capital is Babylon. The summer capitals are in Ecbatana, that's up in Mede territory, and most of all in Persepolis. The fourth capital is Susa. These were all great treasure cities, but the most important treasure city was Persepolis. This was the original home of the Persian rulers. This is where they built their city. This is where the great Persian kings are buried. This is where they built spectacular palaces on an artificial platform above the plain. And here, every year, tribute from the entire empire was brought to the treasure chambers at Persepolis. Yes? Persepolis. It really is a Greek word, not a Persian word. It means Persepolis. Polis is the Greek word for city-state, and this is the city-state of the Persians. Hence, Persepolis, which becomes Persepolis with us. Okay. So, in a yearly ceremony, you had all the various satrapies bring tribute. And what they brought in terms of taxation was whatever they produced most of. So that you had them bringing, for instance, animals. You got them bringing camels, dromedaries, hump, oxen, sheep. You have areas that produce cloth, bringing masses of cloth. Areas that produce gold and silver tend to bring gold and silver, which has been made up into vessels, drinking cups, goblets, this sort of thing, except for the Lydians, of course, who simply sent coins. All of this was amassed in huge treasure chambers at Persepolis, rain after rain that they could call on for their use. And they attempted to keep the taxation as fair as possible. Indeed, there is a fairly general view that the Persians are good governors and are fair governors. The difference between them and the Assyrians is extraordinary. If you look at the reliefs from Assyrian palaces, the Assyrians tended to cover the walls of their palaces, their city gates, with very set types of scenes. One are scenes of warfare, where you have very large Assyrians battling very small enemies, and masses of dead bodies around, heads lopping around, hands cut off, this kind of thing, going with long inscriptions across them, boasting of the slaughter and so forth. The other main kind of scene are scenes of hunting, mainly hunting lions, gazelles, things of this nature. And indeed, again, those scenes tend to center on elements of cruelty. That is, you find scenes of dead and dying lions and lionesses, of a slaughter of animals, of a kind of ferocious death battle going on back and forth. It is certainly a kind of painting, which is carving, which is intended to strike terror in the person's following. When you had people coming to bring tribute there, they had to go by all of these scenes of conquered peoples, beheaded people, all the rest of the corpses and so on, before they come to the Assyrian ruler. Needless to say, by that time, they are quite humbled. It is the use of this kind of propaganda. On the other hand, at Persepolis, the great reliefs still survive. And what those reliefs tend to show is the tribute brought in from the 40 satraps. And you have long scenes which show first a Mede or a Persian court chamber. And he takes the hand of the leader of this group very sweetly, and he draws him in to see the king. And behind him are people carrying cloth, leading animals, and so on. There is no apparent attempt to intimidate, but rather the attempt is simply to show off the grandeur, the power, the wealth of the Persians as such. But no bloodshed, no horror, no hunting. Indeed, where you have scenes of the Persians and Mede soldiers standing on guard, it is somewhat bemusing to find that they certainly wouldn't get by in any of today's armies. The soldiers tend to turn and chat with each other, to hold hands, to offer each other a beer, this kind of thing while on guard. There's a kind of neat informality that runs to this, that gives it a quite different tone from anything that is true with the Assyrians. And certainly, the Persians tended to value culture in every way, to encourage indigenous culture in many ways. They are people who are interested, in fact, in the world and in many parts of it. They widen their experiences constantly. It's true they come from proverbs. One of the famous proverbs that has come is when King Cambyses decides to send armies down to Egypt to conquer Nubia and to conquer the oases of the western desert. Now, they do conquer Nubia, all right, and we know that a great Persian army marched out into the Sahara Desert to try to reach the western oases, Siwa and the others, to conquer them. And that entire army is neither seen nor heard from ever again. It simply vanishes into history. The assumption is, of course, that a huge sandstorm rose and simply buried that entire Persian army. And somewhere out in the wilds of the Sahara is a Persian army waiting to be found by somebody who will dig it up, which is rather fascinating to think about. That was, of course, one famous disaster. Another famous disaster occurred when Darius decided to punish the Scythians. Now, the Scythians were nomadic tribes that roamed the area of southern Russia, the steppes there and the wheat lands. And they were constantly invading down into Asia Minor. So Darius decided to send a great expedition against them. And this is historically the first of the great invasions of Russia that we know about. And it is interesting that here in the very first invasion of Russia, the tactics followed by the Scythians are exactly the tactics the Russians will use against Charles XII of Sweden, against Napoleon, and against Hitler. They seem to be beyond all time what Russians do when invading. The Scythians, of course, were a nomadic people with horses. They were great horsemen. And when Darius marched his armies into southern Russia, they just rode off. And the result was that, you know, so he's got part of southern Russia, but there's nobody there. And the Scythians simply keep wheeling around and attacking stragglers or a baggage train or things like this, and then galloping off into the night. And Darius marches deeper and deeper into Russia, and he never does find any of those damn Scythians. They're always nabbering around the fringes, and then they're gone. And the result is that eventually he simply has to give up and get back out of Russia, having had a nice trip for his pains and lost quite a few soldiers, but with no conquest of the city. Now, this retreat before an enemy, the refusal to give major battle, is, of course, one of those continuing threads in Russian history. And it's nice that it occurs, in fact, at this point. Now, the failure of that Scythian expedition is going to bear other fruit historically, but we won't get there for some time. The thing to remember basically is that the Persian Empire is not only an enormously large and wealthy empire made up of all kinds of different peoples who are armed with different weapons, who wear different types of armor. Some are cavalry, some are infantry. They're enormously varied, and even with different languages. And that all of these simply owe a major allegiance to the King of Kings. But always, as in any huge early empire, with the possible problem of groups breaking away from control if they are given any real opportunity. Nonetheless, there is not massive major rebellion simply because the Persians ruled well. When we come, as we will, to the period of wars between the Greeks and the Persians, there is always a tendency for everyone to root for the Greeks, simply because we like the Greeks better than we do the Persians, and we know a lot more about the Greeks than we do about the Persians. The only thing I want to point out is that no matter how we may feel, the fact is that the Persians are not an evil people, or a wicked people, or a barbarian people, or a backward people. They were probably more cultured than the Greeks. They are enormously cultured, they are literate, they have enormously good government. This is not, in other words, a strange outlying group who deserved to be defeated bloodily, if possible. That's the theory. If you really want to get into any of these nice sort of black and white Star Wars approaches to history, you may hate the Assyrians, but you may not hate the Persians. No, go on.